dialogue.
Thanks. This is actually my second stint as journalist in residence. 10 years ago, when David was director, I was here for like 2 or 3 months. Fantastic experience, and I'm really pleased to be back again, having learned a whole bunch over the last decade, and excited to share with you. This particular talk is going to be a little more, you know, loosely structured, because it's kind of a getting to know you talk, telling you a little bit about me, what I'm interested in particularly right now. I'm actually really excited to be here when there's like material stuff going on, as you'll see, you'll understand why. The stuff I'm currently interested in right now is phase transitions and criticality, and in particular, you know, there's a very interesting analogy there for effective science communication that I'll be talking about. And at the end of the talk, I'd like to get a sense from you, you know, what are the topics that you're interested in? I'll be available to talk to you one-on-one, but also I'd like to hold a couple of, like, workshops while I'm here, things like that, that's a little bit more hands-on and interactive, less lecturing to you, and get an idea of what you guys are interested in so I can figure out how best to structure something like that. So, without further ado, an introduction to me. Lars is correct. I've been a science writer, editor, and communicator for over 20 years, mostly about physics, and I say related topics, but to my mind, it's all related. You know, physics is pretty much tied to everything. It's been mostly freelance, except for a couple of stints as science editor of Gizmodo for a year. Interesting story there. I loved the job, but our parent company got sued by Hulk Hogan. They lost. The award was so big that they went bankrupt, and we were sold to Univision, and Univision cleaned house. Pardon?
Why?
A sex tape. They published a sex tape of Hulk Hogan, and really, you don't want to see it. So that was the big drama in my life for about a year there. I also spent 2 years as program director for the Science and Entertainment Exchange. It's a program of the National Academy of Sciences that fosters interactions, a sort of a cultural exchange program between scientists and Hollywood. I've written 4 popular science books, mostly about physics, although the most recent was on the science of self, and it was called Me, Myself, and Why. There was a little bit of physics in there, but it also covered social psychology and personality tests and genetics and things like that. A lot of what I write about, as you can see, is trying to make this very esoteric topic of physics accessible to a very, very broad general audience. My first book, Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, was sort of like physics for the rest of us. I have a blog called Cocktail Party Physics that right now is mostly weekly news roundups, but started up as just like fun little write-ups of breaking physics news and things like that. And I'm very active on social media. You can find me on Twitter, and if you want to find out more specifics about any of this, there's my website. So that's the boring who I am introduction stuff. Also, my husband, some of you might know, is Sean Carroll. He's a cosmologist at Caltech. So I write things that go from the very esoteric for outlets like Quantum Magazine, which focuses on very abstract theoretical concepts. One of my first pieces for them had to do with the black hole firewall debates, which actually originated here at KITP with Joel Polchinski and Don Merrill. I wrote this for Quanta. It was like put in Scientific American, and this was something that was kind of a hard sell to a general audience. How do you take this very esoteric debate about the black hole information paradox, which covers, you know, things like the holographic principle and all these various things, and I ended up creating kind of a logical argument, creating a logic puzzle, focusing on the 3 core tenets. They can't all be true. One of them has to be wrong. I think Raphael Busso at Berkeley called it the menu from hell. And that actually worked as a really useful way of structuring this very esoteric topic. But I'll also do something very, very mundane for a place like Slate, which is not even remotely a science publication. And there you have to be a little careful. This particular thing was a paper on shell structures and you know, where their weakest part of basically the biomechanics, the physical mechanics of a shell. And we ended up framing it in the notion of, you know, what can physics tell you about the best way to crack an egg? I don't know if many of you are familiar with the classic movie Sabrina. She actually goes and studies culinary arts in Paris, and there's this wonderful scene where he's trying to teach them to crack an egg with one hand. And literally, there's a special sweet spot on the egg that you want to hit just so in order to do that particular thing. It made for a very, very nice opening, and you could actually put in a video, and it proved to be very, very popular with people. And it was the kind of paper that otherwise might not have gotten a lot of attention. So I was really happy with that one. But ultimately, what I, all through the years, I've had this deep and abiding love for phase transitions and criticality. I love materials physics. It bums me out that it is such a hard sell to general interest editors. That doesn't get nearly the love it deserves in terms of the popular science coverage. I don't need to explain any of this to you. Certainly, you're all familiar with the ISEE model, which when I heard about it several years ago, was like, yes, that's the best thing ever. And now, of course, once you know about the ISEE model, you see it everywhere. But of course, what I especially love about it is that it's not as complicated. I don't need to tell any of you. It's not as simple as it seems. I mean, the most obvious phase transition that we use when we tell people what it is water into ice or into vapor, or boiling into vapor. And I just finished an article for Physics World on the Bapemba effect, which may or may not exist. It's this notion of whether hot water can freeze faster than cold water, which is sort of counterintuitive. It's been a debate. It actually started with this guy named Ernesto Mapenda in Africa. He had noticed that his ice cream froze faster if it was hot when he put it into the freezer. It became sort of this classic thing that they put in science education, physics education for like decades. And then in the last decade or so, physicists have gotten interested in this problem again. Particularly along with molecular simulations, they're also looking at the theory behind it. And just last year, a group of physicists came up with sort of a working rudimentary model for how something like this might happen. They used sort of a simplistic ISEE model to test it, and they haven't quite worked out how it would work for water, but it's sort of the first step, sort of figuring out what a theoretical underpinning for this might be. And even better, they predicted that there could also be an inverse effect, where, say, instead of hot water freezing faster than cold, cold water would like heat up faster than hot. Whether that's true or not, water is a very complicated subject, material, so. So far, the experiments haven't really worked on that, but the model is there, and the model says that in some systems, something like this should be possible.
Well, just so you know, there's an expert on the Mapenda effect.
Is there?
Right over there.
Where?
Maria.
Awesome!
So I'm going to talk about this tomorrow morning, I think at 11.
Okay. Who's going to be there for that? That will be me. I love the Mapenda effect. It's fascinating.
It's in the little conference room.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know which one.
Yeah, I do. I've been actually creeping in there. It also, this same sort of broad pattern shows up in all kinds of real world systems. I don't really need to explain this to any of you. Many of you are probably already familiar with this, but in biology, Bonnie Bassler, among others, pioneered something called quorum sensing in colonies of bacteria. Particularly a specific breed that fluoresces when they hit a critical threshold. You essentially get a population density, they get dense enough, suddenly they all start communicating together, and something like a switch turns on and they all start to fluoresce. It's an interesting thing. There's actually a bobtailed squid in the Atlantic that takes in these bacteria, and when they hit a critical threshold, they fluoresce, and he uses that at night to hunt as sort of like an illumination, sort of a way of illumination against the seafloor. I also just finished a piece on swarming. That's another sort of emergent sort of phenomenon where you have sort of like a critical threshold and then suddenly this weird collective behavior. This is a murmuration of starlings, really amazing patterns that they form, and there doesn't seem to be, nobody really knows how this sort of comes about or how they're communicating, but somehow these little individual actions produce collective behavior above a certain density. In Georgia Tech, they work with fire ants. What I love about the Georgia Tech work is they study this sort of as an active matter material, and they'll actually poke it and prod it and do things to it, like using a rheometer or so, and then like figure out what the response of the material is. I also love the fact because fire ants basically can act like either a liquid or a solid. They can build these sort of semi-solid structures like towers. But there's a famous video that Georgia Tech produced that shows them actually pouring the ants out of a teapot, where they sort of behave like almost like a granular media or like a fluid. And the gist of the article is built around a guy at Stanford named Nicholas Ouellette, who was no relation to me, but he's looking for sort of a universal theory of swarms. He comes from a background of fluid dynamics, looked at swarms and thought that looks like turbulence, combined all that with active matter, and is trying to figure out if there's any kind of universal pattern underlying these. it's kind of difficult because even though you see a lot of collective swarming behavior in lots of different species, the mechanisms are all slightly different. So trying to find something that is universal that underlies all of that is a little tricky. But it's, again, a very fascinating area of active research. Obviously, complex networks, the power grid. Phil and I were talking about this just yesterday. He wrote a book on the power grid, and you actually can see things, you know, sort of like energy build up or electricity build up, and at some point it hits a threshold and you get these little avalanches. You see it in the stock market. You see it in the airline hubs. You can sometimes see it in social networks when something goes viral, and you definitely see it in epidemiology, say when a disease breaks out. There's like a threshold there where if you are above or below the threshold determines whether it's going to flourish and spread or whether you can actually stamp it out. Self-organized criticality is something that I ran into at an APS March meeting many, many years ago, and I was thrilled because that was the first time I heard about Per Bach and his Atabelian sand pile. This notion of how, you know, you just keep pouring little grains and it sort of builds up and then it hits like this point where it just can't hold that anymore, and you see these just avalanches down and then it starts building up again. And what I found fascinating, I did this piece for Quanta, there's this new field, over the last like decade or so, looking at self-organized criticality in the brain. And it's advanced enough now that they're actually developing their own meeting and their own journal. I love this because it essentially argues that the brain itself operates sort of near criticality at all times, and that this is sort of essential to functioning properly. I think I talked to Dante Shalvo, and he had this great quote where he said, you know, look, if you're too ordered, you're sort of phase locked and you can't respond to changing conditions. And if you're too chaotic, it's like having an epileptic seizure all the time. So you sort of want to be in this sweet spot in the middle, like sort of like lingering around criticality. So I think his great quote was, if it's like too ordered or too chaotic, it's the brain of an idiot and you couldn't function at all. And you also see sort of phase transitions, say at the quantum to classical transition. Nobody really kind of understands how and when that happens, but they know it does. There's sort of like some breakoff point where quantum behavior, you know, sort of like gives way to more classical dynamics. I just did a piece on the dark matter, which some physicists think might actually have a superfluid phase, which might help solve an enduring conundrum, which is that dark matter seems to behave differently at different size scales, say galaxy clusters versus individual galaxies. And there's even, you know, cosmologists have borrowed an idea from condensed matter physics, like the idea of tensor networks, and have applied that to the emergence of space-time. The idea there being that qubits, little bits of information, sort of like get entangled with each other, and at some point they reach a critical point and you get space-time sort of emerging out of that. All of these things are extremely speculative, but to me it's very interesting that you actually see these patterns over and over and over again. All size scales, lots of different kinds of systems. There's a reason why I love this so much. So, of course, making people care about that is very, very difficult. I care about it. I think it's fascinating. The challenge here is how do you convey this to a general reader? Whenever I, like, tell people that I'm really excited and want to do a book on phase transitions, their eyes start to glaze over. But once I start explaining it to them, they start getting interested. So I think it really depends on how you present it. Cesar Hidalgo is someone I interviewed at MIT. He had this great response to the EDGE question, which was basically, what is the one concept you think the general populace should be more literate in? And he picked criticality. And among other things, he showed that, you know, broad social movements can actually, can actually be used to illustrate this. I think, was the collapse of Lehman Brothers an essential trigger for the 2008 recession, or was the financial system so critical that any disturbance would have done the trick? And more broadly, did Rosa Parks start the civil rights movement, or was the movement already running in the minds of those who had been promised equality and were instead handed discrimination? And those are very provocative questions. He has a great book new out that, from last year called Why Information Grows that I highly recommend. He does a lot of work in econophysics, among other things. It also takes a phase transition to change an individual mind, and I think here we're getting to the gist of the rest of the talk here. There's something called an affective tipping point in psychology, which I was really shocked to find out, and it inspired me to do this essay for a local magazine called Boom in California. It takes a phase transition, and this is how you change minds. Certainly we've seen broad shifts of opinion. There's several scientists who actually model how broad shifts of opinion take place, say attitudes towards gay marriage, things like that, attitudes towards legalizing marijuana. You know, gay marriage in particular, people were opposed, and all of a sudden there was this huge shift. And now it's broadly acceptable. Something like 65-75% of Americans are largely tolerant of gay marriage, and that's huge. Understanding how these kinds of shifts happen is a very interesting question, a very active area of research, very interdisciplinary in nature. So this is where we kind of get into it, because changing an individual mind, you know, what happens with a broad shift of opinion is you start by changing one individual mind, and gradually, as you keep changing people's minds, you get this cumulative effect, and you hit a critical threshold, and stuff change. The same causal process, I would argue, goes on internally with people. You know, people do change their minds, but how that happens is sort of intriguing, and I'm going to explain a little bit why this is such an interesting question. So, when it comes to communicating science, I always say the good news is there's more outlets for doing this than ever. I mean, not just print media and broadcast, tons of online-only news outlets. There's blogs, there's Tumblrs, there's social networks, there's podcasts, there's YouTube. There's all kinds of new tools and new outlets coming out all the time for this. The big difference, of course, is that it's no longer this sort of top-down approach. It's not a lecture. It's no longer you conveying information. It's sort of this two-way street. There's interactions and give and take. It's true communication as opposed to imparting information for the most part. The bad news, as we all know, misinformation still proliferates, particularly in this era of, you know, fake news. And I use fake news in terms of actual fake news and not the way Donald Trump uses it, which is any news he doesn't like. So this sort of stuff still proliferates. And part of the reason is, for a long time, we had this notion of the information deficit model, which is that, it assumes that if people don't understand or are resistant to science or in denial of a scientific result, it's because they don't understand. And all we really have to do is patiently explain the science to them and the facts to them, and they're going to change their mind. You know, you can educate them, and, you know, they'll say, oh, because human beings are logical and rational, and they'll say, of course, you've made your case, I accept. How many people have ever found that to be the case? Outside, say, of science, and even within science, it can be a little tough. And there's a reason for that. People really, really don't like being fed a lot of facts. You know, you may have noticed that you feed people a lot of facts, and they actually double down. You see this in the anti-vaccine debates. You see it with flat earthers, which is the most extreme example. They're a small, very, very dedicated group of people who honestly think that all those pictures from space of a round earth are just there to fool us. Why? I don't know. So we're all what's called motivated reasoners. There's this thing, it's called the backfire effect. Brendan Nyhan, right there in the bottom, is a psychologist who came up with this notion. He actually was studying attitudes towards gay marriage and how you would change minds to them. And he had a group of people, and he tried all these different methods, tried and true. You know, we'll give them the facts, we'll tell them a story and sneak the facts in there. We'll like appeal to their emotions and like really tug at their heartstrings. I, for one, have always been fond of saying, you know, win their hearts and you win their minds. It turns out, you know, it can be a little hard to win their hearts, and this is why. Well, there's something about the human brain that, you know, it builds this little house of based on, you know, family background, experiences, upbringing, whether you have scientific training or not, and it gets information that's contrary to that, and it wants to protect it. It'll kick it out and build a fence and not let it in. The best antidote to this is scientific training, but even so, we're all guilty of it. We all sometimes do this. We're all motivated reasoners, in part because it feels like it's attacking us. It feels like it's part of our identity. And information that is at odds with things that that core beliefs that we hold very, very dear, it's going to feel like a personal attack, and we will respond accordingly. And that means it is extremely difficult to reach people, you know, if you're attacking their core belief. If they don't want to believe in the Big Bang, for example, or if they don't want to accept evolution. So to me, this notion of changing people's, but people do change their minds. And part of that, I've argued, is identity does shift and change over time. So what you need to do is sort of like pick away at them little by little. You plant seeds. I think particularly in science communication, we're very, very focused on metrics and measuring response. And sometimes, you know, we focus on that tipping point. We focus on the big dramatic change. And I would argue that's not what change actually is. In the same way that, you know, we focus too much on like the transition point in the material, the change has been happening all along. It's just that it takes a long time to get to that critical point. It's really about that journey. So I decided that this would be a good topic for a book, and that's what I'm working on right now. I am putting together a book called Plateau, Why Nothing Changes Until It Does. Because that's what's frustrating, right? You think you're getting nowhere with your science communication. You look around you and you think there's so much evidence out there, there's so many facts. We tell people this stuff over and over in countless essays and countless things, and they will not accept reality. They just won't. And I would argue that even though you can't see it, there's still something going on in the surface. And you basically have to, you can't see inside a person's heart, unfortunately. And you kind of have to trust that over time you are having an effect. I think the most broadly relatable example, and this is something Sean and I came up with last summer because he tried to make pork butt. He did it successfully in our little green egg. When you do this, there's something called the plateau or the stall that happens when you cook pork butt. After the first couple hours, it will actually, you're trying to get the meat thermometer to hit a certain internal temperature, right, and then it's done. It'll actually stop at one particular temperature for like hours and hours, sometimes days, and because of evaporative cooling. And there's this guy named Greg Blonder who's actually done some experiments on this. You can actually, if you Google him online, you'll find his website with like all his data and things like that. And what you need to do after the first 2 hours is wrap it in tinfoil, because what's happening is there's all this evaporative cooling, and it hits this sort of point where it sort of balances out the heating up and the cooling off. It just sort of like stays there. And if you just let it go, not only will it take days to cook, but your meat's going to be really tough and dry by the time you're done. So if you wrap it in tinfoil, it counters that. And it'll still take 8 hours, but at least it'll be done. So I thought that was a really great metaphor or analogy for what actually happens internally with an individual or with like collective changing of the mind. So my challenge in writing this book is taking all these disparate pieces and weaving them into a seamless whole. So that's what I'm working on right now. I'm hoping to be able to talk to a whole bunch of you while I'm here, getting ideas, picking your brains, getting, you know, some thoughts about how to do this. Aristotle is famously for saying that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, which is often quoted in regard to emergent systems. So I want to go beyond just having a topic and a whole bunch of really interesting things that I love, create not only just a compelling argument, but a really strong narrative arc that I think that the average reader would find very compelling. And I just think it's very challenging to be doing. My favorite thing, a friend of mine is a physicist, ends up uses these two children's books to talk to people about what makes an actual compelling story. And one of them is called Busy Tractor, and one is called Cat is Sleepy. She's obviously a new mother. But she said that when she does this, she has people read these books when she does these like science writing seminars, and she has them read both of them, and then she has them explain which one they like better. And invariably, they all love Cat is Sleepy, and they're kind of meh on Busy Tractor. And there's a very good reason why. Busy Tractor is just like you have this guy and he's got a tractor, and it's just like a series of updates of what he's doing with his tractor. He does this with his tractor, he does this with his tractor, he does this with his tractor, and then he goes to bed. The cat, you know, is the protagonist, and it wants to find some place to sleep. And it's overcome with sleepiness. That's the inciting incident. And there's all these different complications. Like, he tries all these different things, and they're all unsuitable, and he's getting very tired. And eventually he reaches his goal. So there's an arc there. So I actually, believe it or not, tried and use this whenever I construct a story or a book outline or something like that, because it's a good reminder to me not to just have, say, a collection of facts. The first part of my talk, remember, I was going through all the things I love about phase transitions and criticality. That's a list of facts. That's not a compelling narrative. Turning that into a book requires coming up with a narrative. And the good news about the shape of stories is there's actually a theoretical model. I think the first time I did this, I brought up was Journalists in Residence. We had a whole thing on Hollywood screenwriters, and I actually brought up a couple of TV writers, and he outlined essentially the 5-act structure of a drama, of a TV drama, and we had all the physicists come up with their own TV show based on that. It is a model, and once you see that model, you can never watch TV again without seeing it there. It's like, oh my God, this is so derivative, this is like so formulaic, but you know, there's a reason, I mean, it works. So this is what I need to kind of roughly come up with for the Phase Transitions book. A character or several characters in this case, you have a setting, an inciting incident, they have goals because you need a motivation. You have to be able to make the characters sort of stand out so that they're distinguished from each other and then you have all these different struggles. You have a moment of crisis, a climax where they actually, have some sort of like agency of rescue, and then a sort of a denouement. With a science book, it's very interesting. I mean, how do you get the resolution and the denouement? Because science is an ongoing effort. So you kind of have to find a little mini resolution, I think, more than anything else. So that's what I'm working on. Now it's your turn. This is my challenge to you, because every single one of you, I've been listening to some of your talks, particularly in the memory formation of matter, you're doing incredible work. You're doing work in an area that does not often get popular press, right? It deserves to. And it shouldn't be as hard to sell it as it is, but it is. So my challenge to you is, how will you shape your science into a story? Because there's definitely a story in your research. There always is. And that's kind of what I want to do for the remainder of this. I don't want to sit there and talk at you. I want us to have sort of a conversation. I want us to, maybe we can start with, some brave person telling about their work, and we can all figure out, what are some of the story elements that we can pull out of that. I don't suppose there's anyone who'd care to volunteer. Actually, maybe we could do the Mpemba effect.
Why not leave the surprise for tomorrow? you've written about the Mpemba.
Yes. Pretend I haven't.
Fine. So Mpemba effect is this kind of peculiarity of, first it was noticed as this peculiarity of water, and if it was only this, maybe people wouldn't care so much, but I try to make it into a story by telling people it's really important, it's about ice cream, about making ice cream faster. And so my story is actually part two. Mm-hmm. And first part is by Oren Raz and Lou. And they said, yes.
They were the people I interviewed, yes.
So Mpemba effect is actually a general phenomena, and here's how it happens. And the story that I want to tell today is the part that's missing in their story is sort of, they said it happens in some systems, but they never told us, can it happen in reality? How often do we see it? Do we see it in, as physicists, we know that, relevant systems have, this chair has 10 to the 23 molecules, so the fact that Raz and Lu tell you that it can happen even if you have, three energy levels is fine, but will I see it somewhere? Will an experimentalist be able to see it and use it? These are very cute shortcuts in thermal relaxation. So mm-hmm. That's what I want to talk about.
So, yeah. That's good. I mean, obviously the Mpemba thing is compelling in part because you have this great story with Ernesto Mpemba originally. Yes. He was like a high school student, and he noticed this weird effect, and he asked his science teacher about it, and his teacher laughed at him and basically mocked him and said, that's just Mpemba physics. And there was a visiting physicist who came, and he told him about it, and the guy was intrigued. I mean, he figured the kid was probably wrong, but he decided that he'd go and run his own experiment, and then he found out the kid was right. And they wrote a paper together. That's a great story, and it actually fits into kind of this model. So I agree. I mean, I think there's definitely, but there's a new story now,
So, So the new story is that, actually, you should be able to observe it broadly, right, elsewhere also. And, okay, so we also predict a much stronger version of the Pemba effect, which wasn't known. So we predict a new effect. And
So the protagonist in this story would be you and Oren Roz and,
right.
and these sort of people, these scientists who've decided that this is probably a real thing, a sort of a general effect.
Right.
The dilemma, you know, so we have a character setting, we have motivations, we have an inciting incident, we have all of those things like inherent, right, in that story. The conflict comes from the fact that you have all these, contradictory experiments, and you have a lot of people, other scientists who don't buy it, they don't believe it. How do you convince them? You know, I mean, what needs to happen in terms of all this in order to get that to happen? You know, because those are the steps in the story that take you to, and part of it is, you know, Oren Roz and you and his colleagues, you know, you actually did achieve part of it. You know, the first part of that story is you actually did come up with a theoretical model that showed it was a generalized effect. So part two.
Okay, so actually that would be part three, right?
Part three, yes, exactly.
My colleague, who I don't know, isn't here, but says typically sort of experiment is the place where theory comes to die. They're doing theory, so, you know, probably part three would be somebody taking a part of our work and maybe with us or without us sort of, testing it, seeing it.
And I think last time I spoke to Oren, he actually was collaborating with someone who they were hoping to test out something, at least the inverse effect or something. No?
Possibly. The part two is also with Oren.
So you guys can hear more about that at her talk tomorrow. Was someone about to say something?
It's seen in water. It's seen in granular media also, doing some simulations. In 2012, the Royal Chemical Society decided to, put up a competition for the most. I don't know why it wasn't also the most accurate, but the most imaginative explanation of the effect. So, and then...
Imaginative in a scientific sense, not fairies.
But Pemba was also one of the artists, and in 2016 there was an article questioning it. So the data is all over the place, and it's intimately related on how precisely do you cool or heat your sample. So I believe that, you know, with a different recipe, some recipes might be harder to follow than others. So.
Well, yeah.
So would you call that a crisis in my storyline?
Actually, I think it probably would be. There is a kind of crisis here, you know, brewing. That, you know, it's sort of reached that point, and what we're waiting on is the resolution. You know, we're sort of working towards the climax, agency or rescue of some sort, something that actually like breaks the stalemate, and we get this resolution. So I think that's kind of where we are in the story. I actually pitched a story. There's a woman who's adapting cosmic ray detectors to study Brunelleschi's dome. And every editor I pitched it to said, it's a great story. It has all the narrative elements, but she hasn't done the experiment yet, and so we don't have a resolution. So that's kind of, I'm waiting. Waiting for her to finish the experiment. But you need all those elements, you know? So this is actually, you know, when you're thinking of, I have a really cool paper, I'm doing something really cool, I'd like it to get some coverage, these are the elements, you know, final little elements that will make a journalist's like ears prick up, that will tell them that, oh, I can actually make a compelling story out of this. So anyone else want to go next?
I just want to make another comment.
Okay.
Physicists tend to be excellent storytellers, and when they give an invited talk at a conference, you can pretty much expect, this kind of narrative arc. One of the things that I struggle with if I go to a conference that might be, you know, engineering or math, is that they don't necessarily have the same culture that we do. You know, a theoretical mm-hmm. physics talk has the narrative, and sometimes other talks are lists of facts.
Yes, they are.
You know, and...
Although I've seen some physics talks that were lists of facts.
Oh, yeah. But they're the ones where you end up, like,
right.
not getting, you know, you get all the trees, but you miss the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we have to do when we train our students to be good communicators is to think in terms of the narrative arc.
Right.
How do you create drama in the talk? How do you make the audience care about the result that you're struggling to communicate?
Right.
And so it's not just for the general public, it's actually for us too.
Yes, I have that argument all the time about why every student, every physics student, grad student should receive some training in this, because it actually makes you a better communicator professionally.
And every grant proposal.
Exactly. Got to build an argument.
Now, just to ask a question about what Robin said. In your observation, I mean, how much of that is true when your research involves theory making? So, in other words, the connection between theory making and storytelling.
Interesting, you know, because there's an argument to be made that theorists are coming up with a compelling story to explain a phenomenon, right? And it has to match the data. So there is an element of that. I think I pointed out when I wrote the Black Hole Firewalls piece, I focused on the logical argument, and that sort of became the narrative arc. You know, there's this story that we've been telling ourselves about black holes and what happens when you cross the event horizon of a black hole that we've been telling ourselves for decades based on general relativity. What happens when quantum mechanics comes in and you get these like this clash, and physicists thought they'd resolve that clash, and then Joe Polchinski and three others decided that, oh, actually we haven't quite resolved it. And so what you've got since then is a whole bunch of different physicists taking that conundrum again and coming up with stories that they think can explain it or resolve that dilemma. And the issue there being that there's so many different stories and no one knows which one is the right one. Yes?
A few years ago, Alan Alda came here.
Yes.
To give us a talk on how to teach physics, right? And one of the things he, of course, suggested that there would be a story line,
yeah,
which, like you're talking about as far as exposition, but he also stressed the importance of negative, painful elements. So that's what people remember.
They do.
Right. So shouldn't the cat have been eaten by the dog by sleeping in the wrong place?
Well, not necessarily been eaten, but it did actually suffer.
You've got to remember the recent events, because
yes,
my house almost burned down.
Yes.
Right? And we're without water and power. And so
the cat actually did have many bad things happen to it.
So how would you get negative things into phase transitions? Would people remember them more? I mean,
they might. You know, this is interesting because I run into this problem a lot when I interview scientists in general. Nobody wants to talk about the struggles or say the infighting and the arguments and things like that. They want to like talk about the results and the work and that sort of thing. But the emotional content. I mean, physicists, you guys are passionate, man. I've seen you guys almost come to blows over stuff. Finding ways to convey that, you know, and to let those conflicts be and to let them be part of the story is something that I think many scientists are reluctant to do. And it makes for a very, very compelling story. Yes?
So I think there are a number of people here who might actually remember something about one of the things you put up there, which was the sandpile picture of Perbach. And so, you know, the theorists here can jump in as they feel free or not, but according to Perbach, shows as his metaphor a pile of sand. And experimentalists actually went out and said, oh, I can actually make a pile of sand and see whether I'm going to get avalanches of, you know, in some sort of power law distribution.
Right.
And it turned out, in order to do that, you had to really tune the way that you actually pile
yes.
stuff on. And so there was this incredible, I mean, various occasions, but one occasion in particular when people really got into yelling matches about
yeah.
this. And so you know, a lot of the younger people may not have been aware of this or participated, but I mean, this was, your example is you may not have ever heard of this, but I mean,
oh, yes, I have. I was there.
Okay, so, you know, this is...
And it stuck with me.
There was a lot of pain associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
A few other examples, too, in the granular world where
mm-hmm.
actually some really very, very good theorists said, we've discovered how forces are carried in granular materials. These dumb engineers, oh, don't take it away. It was very close.
Mm-hmm.
I've been struggling since the time of Coulomb, and we've figured it out. And it turned out actually not to be the case, but we've created a firestorm that actually made a schism in between the physics and engineering mechanics world for a long time.
Right. And that's a great part of the story. I mean, it's definitely part of the story. Yeah.
Maybe to tie the ends together, so a pain painful negative example of a phase transition is the mudslides themselves.
Yes.
And a broader problem with that that I'm interested in is the schism between, or the lack of acceptance of these ideas from criticality and phase transitions into the engineering application type models that are used for these actually results in lives lost and things like that.
Really?
Yeah, and there's real, I mean, and I and others have experienced that when you try to introduce these new ideas from criticality into problems with actual consequences, because it's such a different way of thinking, there's actually, so there's negative consequences to people, but then there's debates within the science communities because you're trying to take this idea and translate it into a field for application. Mm-hmm. And there's total resistance. You don't even allow to see if the idea can be more predictive because it's such a different way of thinking.
We talked about the backfire effect. This is the backfire effect in science and engineering. Like I said, everybody is a motivated reasoner. I'm sorry, I'm getting over a sinus infection. And that's what it is. I mean, all of their experiences, there's a way they've always done things, their upbringing, their training, their personal experience, all of this, this is how we do things, this works for me. I reject this new information because I am just congenitally, my brain is just like wired that way. So even scientific training is not enough necessarily. They don't trust you. I mean, they feel attacked. They feel like you're coming in and saying we can do this better and that you don't really respect them. And so they push back and they double down and they deny, and people die as a result. And that's a good story. So, I mean, what your research is on what?
That stuff.
That stuff.
No, I mean physics of the physics of how landscapes evolve.
Oh,
how
interesting.
Material science and granular physics and, you know, phase transitions can be used to understand how landscapes behave.
So that's beautiful. So yes, absolutely, you could do a story about that, and it would be a great feature article. Among other things, you could use the landslide. You can get these people's personal stories. You can talk to David about, you know, him having to evacuate because, and how the landslide just sort of like didn't happen, whoosh. You know? And then you also have like the internal conflicts of trying to work with engineers and introduce these new ideas and having them be resistant, and how do you get beyond that? Question is, how do you resolve it? And hopefully you'll win them over. I mean, how do you win them over? I mean, do you go to conferences or do you like meet with them or?
I'm hopefully nearing the climax. I mean, that's a side story, but I and others have been accused of scientific misconduct and other things in our writing. In other words, that the agreement between these simplistic ideas and reality couldn't possibly be true. Mm-hmm. And therefore, so it's, I don't know. I don't know how to do it. It's pretty serious. I'm shocked at how much character assassination has happened in you know, personal attempts.
Engineers
and neuroscientists.
Interesting.
So I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do it.
Interesting. Well, yeah.
It's not so simple.
It's not.
Because Fairbach is a wonderful example of somebody who had a bright idea and it sounded right, and it turned out not to be right.
Exactly.
And if, in fact, you're using that idea carefully and you're making predictions that affect people, you're harming people, too.
Yeah, oh, no.
And look, the whole point is that
you have stories about
it. Look, I'm in the middle of, being making engineers angry all over the place. And in fact, Jennifer even heard me give a talk about it. I just got a terrible referee's report. It was absolutely dumb, and I wrote a long essay, and we'll see what happens. But but these are situations where you really have to be a scientist. You have to have an open mind on both sides, including to have an open mind to consider the possibility that you're wrong. And if you don't consider that possibility, and if you don't listen to the people who are complaining about it, and compose serious answers, you're also not doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree, but you know, human beings do science, and you're getting these tensions where they're not, you know, not wanting to listen to you, you know, and you can't start having this dialogue. I'm sure you're more willing to admit that you, you know, you could be wrong, right? But you can't even have that dialogue if all they're doing is pushing you away and refusing to listen.
That's right.
So, yes.
So sometimes the KITP workshops actually do that. And I actually remember what Bob was saying. So the German genealogy workshop in 1998, that brought for the first time, I think, engineers and physicists together to talk about granular materials. And there was huge tension, but I think it eased some of it by just having people talk to each other.
Yeah.
I should say, I was a former writer in residence here, too. And for much of my professional career, I was in charge of the APS press room and have written a million press releases trying to do exactly, and Jennifer's really onto something, you're telling a story. One of my last jobs was working at the Joint Quantum Institute, and I was given the job of trying to rewrite an article that we'd submitted to Nature. They wanted, but they wanted it more, and you're going to be pleased with this, they wanted it told more in the way of a story.
Nature's going more towards that,
Nature,
it's true.
Nature is a terrific journal, we all know that. Now I'm wondering, we have a couple of very high-ranking former and present officials of the American Physical Society. Will FISREP letters, what's FISREP letters, if I could put you on the spot, would they allow extra room, or do they put a premium on storytelling?
Phil, you should identify yourself.
Well,
I'm Phil
Chewy.
I used to work for the American.
I will say this, that Nature, even though it's an academic journal, there's also a magazine portion. And when they talk about, so they have this news reporting fashion, and that's where you're getting the storytelling aspect.
Well, this was an article going to be, you know, a research article, not a news item.
Interesting.
Some of us have a feeling that Nature does more harm to science.
But, you know, I read physics papers from time to time, or at least attempt to, and I've gotten better at it over the years. And, you know, but there is a structure, yeah?
No, sorry, you just said what I wanted to say. The physical review letters, like a storytelling structure or not, there is a well-defined structure. Mm-hmm. I guess one could ask whether that's a good one, or it could be...
I don't know why you guys are all in love with the passive voice, but that's just universal across academia. Stop it. there's a diction, right, that we use when we write papers, and I actually think that papers would be far more readable and enjoyable if you just switched from to a more direct, active voice as opposed to passive. This experiment was done versus we did this. it can actually make it actually makes a huge difference, and everything else can be exactly the same, and you just change everything to an active voice, and it would be incredibly much better.
So I wonder if you could say a little bit, particularly in regard to Nature, because a journal like that, maybe Science, is extremely driven by citations.
Yes.
And so in some sense, it also comes back to your, you know, social aspects, because if you can get someone to cite your article 1,000 times, then you've got a much better chance, or if the Nature editor, say, thinks that your article will be cited 1,000 times, it will get much more attention than maybe a better piece of science that might only get 100 citations.
Yes. And honestly, that's not just Nature and scientific publications. I spent a year as science editor at Gizmodo, I think you mentioned, and that was, I mean, a high traffic site. You know, they got something like 35 million hits a month. It was just huge traffic. And you see the same thing. You see a lot of really, I wrote a lot of very thoughtful, long stories about nuclear power and cutting edge theoretical physics and really cool quantum mechanical stuff. But the thing that I posted that got the most traffic was a really funny improv everywhere time travel video. It got like 2 million hits. And so there's always this push-pull between Nature, which is trying to make money, right? It's a professional journal, but it's also a commercial journal. And there's a market that they have to meet. Same thing happens in science journalism. It's also why it's so hard to get material stories in there. They're looking for that hot, sexy topic that the readers will just gravitate towards and boost their traffic so that they can charge more to advertisers and make money and stay afloat. And the problem is, good stuff goes, you know, good work doesn't get covered, good stories fly under the radar. the stories I'm most proud about at Gizmodo didn't get nearly that number of hits, like orders of magnitude less traffic. But I was proud of them, and I felt that the 20,000 readers who did read them, I really, you know, really appreciated it. So.
It's a very crude, easy to measure.
Pardon?
Number of hits.
Yeah.
Any medium is a very easy to measure. Mm-hmm. The quality of the hits can't be measured.
Exactly.
What you really care about, and you were just explaining, is the number of hits times the average quality per hit.
Right.
One you can't measure, so you rely on the other. That's
one
of the reasons nature distorts not just the scientific communication, the economic issues. They make 50% of profits.
Right.
Out of our work, which they own and we pay for. And but they also distort via citations, which only count numbers which they amplify.
Right.
Our whole process of rewarding, recognizing, hiring people. So we're. That's what I mean by
Right. But I think there's a version of that does happen in the popular press as well, where, you know.
Because you can't measure your effectiveness.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have people come up to you of those 2 million hits for the time travel thing, which they glanced at and threw away and don't remember anything, as opposed to one of your deep articles.
That people really remember like a year later.
Quality wise.
Right.
That would be much more important.
Right, but for some reason the metric...
In the case of hiring people or recognizing scientists, we, in the end, care really about the quality first.
Right.
But that's not easy, and nature doesn't care. Which is why what appears in nature, that's why they distort this, that's why they also had the majority of the fraud cases, even in physics. Because in those cases, we know that what happened was they overruled referees who said this is probably wrong and needs to be reproduced.
It's because it was a hot story and they wanted the hits.
Because they could make money off it.
Right.
So.
And that's a problem. There's no answer to that. Hello.
Well, there might be an answer to it, but there's no answer if all you count.
Is the traffic, the citations, the hits, the traffic, exactly.
So I guess there is also a question there whether people that do communication in science like you do can help with respect to this type of problem, which is
we have the same problem. I mean, it actually came up also when I was working with the Science Entertainment Exchange, because, you know, how do you measure progress in a program like that? What's your metric? And we got asked that over and over again, and I just said, that's the wrong question. Because you want me to, you know, we had to find things to count. And so we could count the number of consults, but they didn't tell you anything about the quality of those interactions. You could have like 10, you know, 25 really like, really quick things that weren't very, very successful, or have one like really in-depth 2-hour conversation that had a significant impact on improving the depiction of science in a major film. That's a huge quality interaction. It developed into a lasting relationship. Those people continued to collaborate for years after. Pardon?
Sounds like a KITP program.
Yes, exactly. I mean, how do you measure that? And when you do grants, when you're getting money from people, you have to like come up with some kind of metric to justify this. And I get why that needs to be there, but it's hard to measure something subjective like quality, especially something like this, like that kind of interaction that. It's like you plant a seed and it grows, but you don't necessarily know right away how it's going to develop and grow and how it's going to spread. Yes?
I mean, there's an interesting side to this particular discussion, which is that if you look at
we're almost done.
The broader society, and if this topic came up in a general audience about metrics, people would probably be inclined to say that this is a disease imposed, you know, inflicted upon society by the scientists. it's like this idea of measuring things with numbers.
Right.
Is something that's sort of been.
Not just science. I mean, the insurance people do the same thing, you know.
Insurance.
What was it?
Historically as well.
I think Charles Babbage famously tried to like categorize different types of jokes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add something about telling a story. So I understand that it's important for
communication to the general audience, but as regards scientific discussion between scientists, I see it as a danger because I know many people who have, a few people who perform science with a story in mind. That this weather things that do not fit the stories I want to tell a priori.
Right. And that's confirmation, that's that motivated reasoning confirmation bias, and that's always a danger. I mean, you fall in love with your own story to the point where you constructed this like story and the data comes in and it doesn't support your story, what do? Good scientists will change the story. But if you fall in love with it, if you fall in love with your theory, if you decided that you actually really, really want this to be true, then you won't. I think you were pointing that out, James.
That's true, in particular to the journal who wants stories. I mean, yeah. People who want to publish in this journal, say, firstly...
Look, any tool is a double-edged sword, right? A story can be both good and bad. I mean, it can be used to, like, be really effective means of communication. It can be used to mislead. It can be used to, like, make you closed off to, like, you know, other information. But nonetheless, it's a good thing to understand for, you know, and for the structure is good, yes. We're running out of time, so this is our last question.
In communicating, say, the internal coherence of theory, how do you deal with the fact that much of the general public theory means not in practice?
Yeah, they don't understand modeling at all. I agree. And I run into this all the time. I'll pitch a story, and it'll be like a model of some sort. And they'll say, but they didn't actually do an experiment, so why do you care? I actually ran into that problem with the Mpemba effect. That's why I wrote it for Physics World. Physics World loves the theory. but I couldn't pitch that anywhere else, because even though it had all these great story elements, they didn't understand the importance of this theoretical model. So yes, that's an issue. And that's just one of my little goals, you know, in terms of my wanting to work towards a phase transition in people's appreciation for theoretical modeling. Because you're right, they don't understand why it's important and why it can be significant, even if there's no experiment backing it up. Obviously, it's great when there's both. But yes, people don't understand that. So this has been great. I'm glad you guys are all like dynamic and interested. I want to be talking to all of you the next day until I'm here till February 16th. Tell me what you want to see. I mean, I will actually, if there's a particular topic or workshop that you want me to organize, we can do that. Just kind of brainstorm about. I did a whole bunch the last time I was a journalist in residence. I can revive one or two of those.
And those are online. Too.
Those are online. But if there's a topic in particular that you'd be especially interested in, if you want to like try and like write your own TV show, we can bring a screenwriter up and we can work together on it, right? We can do that. So let me know what you're interested in doing. All right? And guys, thanks so much. I think we're going to have wine and cheese.